Hello, I'm Sahil Rahman, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, resurrecting coal in Europe. Several European nations reactivate coal-fired plants after a ban on Russian fossil fuels. Could that fill the energy gap? And will climate goals go up in smoke? Also this week, Joe Biden calls it the final piece of his domestic agenda. The Inflation Reduction Act is the latest legislative win for the US president, tackling climate, healthcare and tax. But is it enough? After years of exponential growth, tech giants suffered painful losses this year. So why are investors ditching technology stocks? And is the party over for the sector? The European Union is trying to save gas for winter as Russian energy flows become increasingly uncertain. But the bloc has to burn something else to fill the gap. And it's looking to coal, the most polluting fossil fuel, despite a plan to cut carbon emissions in the coming years. The International Energy Agency says the EU's coal consumption is set to rise by 7% this year. However, it could face a shortage in supply. A ban on Russian coal came into force earlier this month. The European Union banned Russian coal imports in response to the invasion of Ukraine as part of sanctions in April. It says the measure is expected to cost Moscow more than $8 billion in lost revenue a year. The bloc imports almost half of its coal from Russia, with Germany, Poland and the Netherlands the biggest buyers. Almost 70% of the EU's thermal coal, which is used in power and heat generation, comes from Russia. Now, some member states have extended the life of coal plants or reopened others to safeguard power supplies. Others have ramped up supplies from several other countries, including Colombia, Australia and the US. Poland particularly relies on coal rather than gas for power and heating. The country is now facing widespread coal shortages after Russian imports of fuel were banned. Andrew Simmons reports now from Katowice.
Poland prides itself on its potential for being totally independent of Russia for its energy needs. But there's a problem. It's a shortage of coal, not gas like the rest of Europe. Rafał Rohr's coal cellar is normally stocked up for winter by now, but he can't find any coal to buy. And if he could, he'd pay almost four times what he used to.
I'm not a miner or a geologist, but the coal is right here beneath our feet. And I've been trying to buy it for 3 months with zero results.
He's right. This region is rich with coal, but Polish production is limited and the government has banned imported coal from Russia, even though it's cheaper and more suitable for domestic use.
We didn't invest in nuclear power yet. We cannot rely on natural gas, so all we have is coal. When it comes to the heating sector, the situation is even worse because we were heavily dependent on Russian coal.
Poland burns a lot of coal, 87% of the total for households across the European Union. Coal mines surrounded by queues of trucks can't meet the demand.
And if people knew the level of profiteering going on, they'd be even more alarmed. There's a reason that truck drivers from all over Poland are spending days on end in queues like these. It's because the loads may be small, but the profits are big.
Drivers are known to make at least 100% profit from a coal yard dealer, who will then raise the price by at least another 100%. This driver admits the sick and old will suffer.
What the government should do is give pensioners a special allowance on coal, delivered to their door. It's sick. I don't want to profit from human misery, but that's how it is.
The government says an annual coal allowance of around $630 a year will help. And ministers say companies are importing coal ahead of the coming winter.
Polish companies are now importing coal from other countries, from Colombia, Indonesia, South Africa, and replacing with that the quantities of coal that were coming from Russia. It's a bit of a different logistics, so it creates challenges.
But right across Poland, people like this homeowner feel the government isn't doing enough.
Joining me now from Berlin is Professor Carsten Neuhoff. Now, Carsten leads the Climate Policy Department at the German Institute for Economic Research and is the professor at the Institute for Economics and Law at the Technical University of Berlin. It's good to have you with us on Counting the Costs, sir. I mean, the coal ban has now gone into effect. I mean, how much of a coal shortage crisis is looming for Europe, generally speaking?
Well, coal is largely shipped across the globe. So the ban on Russian coal just primarily means that we are getting coal from other regions of the world. The prices have exploded on global coal markets. So I think that is affecting everyone that uses coal. We have only one big issue right now due to the drought. A lot of the shipping inland in Europe is constrained. That is the more bigger concern right now.
So what do you make of that sort of situation in Europe, that coal is re-emerging now as a primary energy source and it comes, as you say, at a cost?
We see, I think, a transition strategy over the next 2, perhaps 3 years to have a bit more coal throughout this period than was planned. At the same time, the emission targets for the year 2030 are firm and they will be reached by accelerating the renewable deployment, rather than by more coal beyond this very short period of crisis right now.
I mean, many are still debating sort of the potential effect, though, on issues and the net effect, really, on climate change. I mean, the IEA says that EU's demand is to rise by 7%. That's a considerable amount, even if it's in the short term.
Well, yes, on the coal, certainly. And we know that to produce 1 megawatt hour of electricity from coal takes three times more CO2 emissions than if you do that with gas. But at the same time, we do see big efforts to save gas across Europe as much as internationally. And this will at the same time also save on emissions. So the net effect for European emissions, I would anticipate, is going to be a reduction of emissions altogether due to the large savings triggered by programs and the very high prices for fossil fuels.
I mean, the debate continues amongst critics. They often talk about the fact that, you know, Europe was previously shutting down coal-fired plants. It was still getting polluting fuel from Russia in the form of coal. I mean, where does Europe, for example, get its coal now in this dilemma that Europe is facing? Because it's damned if it does and it's damned if it doesn't.
Well, I think fossil fuels have a horrific footprint, and I think this indeed is something that you see in the policy arena, where policymakers are really struggling how to respond to the situation. You have big coal exporting countries, both in the OECD, like US or Australia, but also beyond this. And in a way, any fossil fuel you buy has a footprint before it ever reaches Europe, and then when you burn it in Europe. So this is, I think, the reason why a lot of policymakers attempt to accelerate this phase out of fossil fuels. And at the same time, want to balance this to ensure energy is available and, to some extent, if you can still talk about this, affordable in this transition period.
Of course, the ban on coal aims to sort of punish Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. How painful is this still going to be for Moscow in the short term and the long term, in your assessment?
So far, Russia can still export then the coal to some other parts of the world, and the global coal prices, typically in the range of 50 euro, have increased to something like 350 euro. So even if Russia needs to sell at a discount, I think at the moment it is certainly probably not very painful for Russia.
I mean, when we talk about renewables as well, I mean, how complacent has Europe been not to have a backup plan in the years leading up to this particular event and the invasion of Ukraine and all that's come with it when it comes to both gas and coal supplies? Because at the end of the day, they haven't implemented those green policies as quickly as many would have liked. What do you think the urgency is now? Is there an urgency? Do you get that impression from the noises being made from various capitals across the continent?
I think there's a seen by everyone the urgency to really make additional energy available to replace gas, particularly stronger now, and obviously coal then by 2030 as well. And this, I think, is reflected in this additional increase of the renewable target from 32 to 40% of all energy to be provided by renewables by 2030 for Europe. This obviously then needs to be backed up by a set of policies to finance the investment in the renewables, to facilitate the integration of the grids, and to do all the things around our energy systems to allow for that, such a shift. And I think if you look across European ministries and in Brussels, everyone has been working throughout the summer to kind of help to make this regulatory framework fit for purpose.
It's good to get your insight and your thoughts as well. Professor Carsten Norhoff joining us from Berlin. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
The higher prices for food, housing and energy have left incomes overstretched. Polling suggests millions of Americans angry about the rising cost of living. President Joe Biden has said taming inflation is his top priority, and he signed into law a sweeping $750 billion tax, healthcare and energy bill, which aims to lower prices and tackle global warming. It's a major victory for the president and the Democratic Party ahead of midterm elections in November.
This bill is the biggest step forward on climate ever, ever. And it's going to allow us to boldly take additional steps toward meeting all of my climate goals and the ones we set out when we ran. We're going to cut the deficit, point out, by another $300 billion with the Inflation Reduction Act over the next decade. We're cutting deficits to fight inflation by having the wealthy and big corporations finally begin to pay part of their fair share.
A larger $2 trillion spending package known as the Build Back Better Act stalled in Congress last year. The new legislation, though less than Biden originally wanted, aims to achieve many of the same goals. One of its top priorities is making healthcare more affordable. The bill will give Medicare the power to negotiate the prices of certain prescription drugs. Expiring healthcare subsidies will be extended for 3 years. And it's the largest climate investment in American history. Almost $400 billion in new spending will go towards clean energy and climate projects to help cut carbon emissions by 40% by 2030. Much of the money to fund the initiatives will come from tax reforms, including a new 15% minimum tax on large corporations. The Inflation Reduction Act is the latest in a series of legislation delivered by Congress that could help form the core of President Biden's economic record. His wins include an almost $2 billion rescue plan to help get workers and businesses through the pandemic, which was approved last year, plus a $1 trillion infrastructure bill and around $280 billion in spending to encourage domestic semiconductor manufacturing and scientific research to counter China. I'm joined now by Sami Chart in Geneva. He's the chief economist at Lombard Odier Bank. Good to have you with us on the programme. I mean, we've been discussing the impact of burning more coal in Europe on those climate goals. How much would sort of the new US climate bill law help to save the planet, if at all?
Well, the short answer is that it is not necessarily a short-term game-changing piece of legislation. Now, it's nonetheless a pretty well-designed bill. It addresses significant challenges when we think about energy and climate and healthcare. But it is a 10-year plan. It's relatively small numbers when you think about the scale of the U.S. economy, when you think about the immense challenges that we face when we think about climate. And it is on a 10-year horizon. So, you know, perhaps on the margin, it is going to help. It is necessary. But in the short term, the impact is going to be relatively small.
And of course, they have to consider inflation. I mean, this act is called the Inflation Reduction Act. But how much does it really tackle inflation? I mean, doesn't the Federal Reserve really and its decisions on interest rates really determine where inflation sits?
Absolutely. Well, the transmission mechanism to limit inflation is mostly via the reduction in the deficit, but also via trying to reduce healthcare costs. So it might have a minor impact. But again, it is a 10-year plan. The Fed is facing inflationary pressures and has to try to dampen them in the next 3 to 6 months. This is not the kind of time horizon in which we expect a lot from the IRA. So relatively limited impact on the short term, but in the long run, you know, limiting deficits also means that fiscal policy is moving in the same direction than monetary policy, and that is a good thing.
I mean, what do you make of critics blaming Biden over the pandemic stimulus plan and how that's infected inflation? Is or was that policy part of the problem?
Indeed. I mean, it did generate a very significant demand boom that now results in inflation. But it was a policy choice. We also have to keep in mind that, you know, perhaps the inflation that we have today is the price that we have to accept to pay for getting out of the pandemic extremely quickly, with relatively limited damage to the job markets in the long run.
And of course, I mean, nobody wants to see damage to the economy, as you say, but the cost of living for every individual, including many Americans, is the big issue. What can the president do to reduce the pain here?
Well, it needs to keep moving in the same direction as the Federal Reserve, right? Policy has to be committed into limiting short-term inflationary pressures. Pretty clear that the U.S. Federal Reserve is going to shift to a restrictive stance and probably stay there. We will know more relatively soon on that front. So basically, the U.S. government had to act in the same way and basically not put forward policies that might actually increase spending and therefore inflation.
If the president and the Federal Reserve are working, you might say, independently, they also have to work together to tame inflation. And that comes with its own risks, doesn't it? Because there are many factors that are influencing global inflation right now. So what direction do you think, or do you see the American scenario following?
Well, there are two sides. No, first of all, we have to accept slower demand. There is going to be a gross cost into fighting inflation. It does mean that we will have to see some damage to the labor market. But there again, there are two scenarios. It can be very significant and uncontrolled damage, or it can be relatively mild well-organized damage, thinking about a mild recession or a so-called relatively soft landing, despite the fact that there will be some cost. So that's one. Engineer a slowdown in demand, hoping that that slowdown won't be too severe. And the second part is make sure that the supply side of the economy continues to operate in the right way, making sure that the supply side stress continues to abate. So we're seeing Chinese reopening here. We're thinking about commodity prices as well. We're thinking about the cost of shipping and also potentially labor shortages. So it's really about the supply side and the demand side of the economy going in the same direction for an improved inflation outlook.
And of course, you know, any policy has to be a win-win policy financially for the public at large. And as we sort of head towards the end of the summer and into the autumn, a win at the ballot box in midterm elections is very important. So is money in the pocket the positive difference that Americans will vote for, in your opinion?
Well, again, what is very important today for the administration is to be budget neutral. This is all that has been designed in the IRA, making it a budget neutral piece of legislation. So, yes, there is increased spending. There are credit subsidies. But the idea is that, you know, you count on raising revenues from minimum tax and some other elements. So pretty clearly, whatever happens in the midterms, it's not going to be easy for the administration to have the same level of freedom of action when it comes to legislate. So there will be a hung government in a way of some form of opposition, which means that whatever the Biden administration wants to do, it has to do it before the November election, because after that, we're going to be in some form of political gridlock.
Interesting times. Good to get your insight. Sami Chah there from Lombard Odier
Thank you so much.
Bank in Geneva. Thank you very much. The pandemic has wreaked havoc around the world in the past 2 years, from travel and tourism to manufacturing. But one sector has reported eye-watering profits: tech giants. Apple, for example, had so much extra money that it bought its own shares with more than $90 billion. That's almost as much as Kenya's annual GDP. Now, though, as the world opens up, people are relying less on technology to shop, work and play. Apple lost its status as the most valuable company in the world earlier this year. Shares of technology firms like Shopify and Netflix have been in freefall in the past few months, plummeting as much as 70%. Tech companies like Amazon and Apple recorded better-than-expected results for the second-quarter earnings, but many firms are scaling back hiring and slowing down spending plans. Well, to discuss all of that, I'm joined now by Daniel Ives from New York. Daniel is the Managing Director and Senior Equity Research Analyst at Wedbush Securities. Good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. I mean, in general terms, Daniel, what do you make of sort of the tech giant sales and profits in this quarter?
Look, I think overall it's been better than feared. I think many were expecting Armageddon. And I think you ultimately look at Microsoft, Apple, Amazon across the board, holding up firmer than expected. But clearly, there's darker storm clouds on the horizon, given what we see in the macro.
Why are investors then, in theory, selling off their shares and stocks in tech when these companies have been on a winning streak for, what, decades? I mean, why are they being ditched now?
Yeah, look, I think tech stocks overall, I think they overcorrected earlier this year. But it's a Rubik's Cube macro. I mean, given what we see on the Fed, given a recession and the hiking of interest rates, I think what we're seeing is just a risk off across the market, and tech stocks are front and center. So I think there's a fear of what's around the corner as we go into the second half in 2023 with the recession. And I think that's why you've seen tech stocks under such pressure. And even though these have been such sort of golden darlings over the last few years, that's why multiples have compressed like they have.
I mean, you talk about recession. I mean, the global economy is a huge question mark for many countries around the world and for the businesses in those sovereign states. I mean, what are the main challenges for tech companies anywhere in the world, no matter where they're established?
Look, I think there's uncertainty across the board. I think the bigger worry is, you know, how this is going to all play out, if it's going to be a soft landing or a hard landing. How does that affect consumers as well as the enterprise environment? And also, it's a complex geopolitical as well. And I think when you look at big tech, as well as, you know, I look at names even like Tesla across the board, you're going to have some demand around the edges come off. But we're still very bullish in tech stocks into the second half of the year. I think tech's overcorrected. And I can tell you, covering tech over, you know, the last few decades, it's extremely negative in terms of the sentiment on Wall Street.
I mean, it's hard to see the bubble bursting, perhaps, for tech giants in, you might say, the public domain when the public at large look at tech giants like Apple and the rest of them. I mean, it only takes one good idea, one new development, sort of to make things quicker, faster, more efficient. And those tech giants are back on top again. I mean, how do you see that development happening in the years ahead?
I think for tech, they're Rock of Gibraltar. They've almost become utilities for the average consumer. And that's why you look at Apple. I mean, you're talking about an install base of almost 2 billion, you know, in terms of consumers. And even when we look at iPhone 14, I look down the road, I look at Apple in terms of having AR, VR headset, which would be Apple Glass. And we ultimately believe Apple Car in 2025. You look at the cloud in terms of Microsoft, Amazon, Google. That's not going away. We're going to have clearly a recession, but we believe it's going to be short. And ultimately, on the other side of this, that's why we want to be owning tech stocks. In my opinion, these are the best ways to go.
There's a couple of new developments happening in the last few days. One was President Biden sort of investing through his new legislation into sort of semiconductors and chips. Also, we're looking at big companies like Apple thinking about moving their operations from China to countries like India, perhaps. I mean, there's a lot of movement there, isn't there? What do we have to look out for as sort of the big game changers?
Look, I think there's movement, but realistically, probably in the next 5-7 years, I mean, you maybe have 3-4% that moves away from China to the U.S., India, or some other countries. I think the reality is that the supply chain is cemented in Asia.
If investors are questioning where they put their money when it comes to investment, especially in tech stock, what do tech companies then have to do, besides invent something new perhaps, to attract those investors back, or at least give investors the encouragement that they shouldn't be left behind?
Well, I think one thing is really around cutting some costs and making sure margins stay firm during a recession. I think you've seen that from Apple, Microsoft, Google, among others, you know, in terms of cutting costs. But also they have to make sure that the growth stories continue. And I think that's some of the challenge that you're seeing with Netflix. But then on the other hand, if you look at Facebook, I think that's why they're going through such a massive transformation in terms of to the metaverse and really away from social media. But ultimately, it's really holding their hands during these transitions. That's why ultimately in this market, names like Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, those are some of our favorites. Facebook's an example of a company where they have to really get through that transformation to the metaverse for investors to believe that that's going to be successful.
Interesting chat. Good to get your insight. Daniel Ives, their Managing Director of Wedbush Securities in New York. Thanks so much for joining us on Counting the Cost. And that's our show this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at @so_Rahman and to use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net. That's our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Sahil Rahman from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news is next here on Al Jazeera.